Okay, you've got your eyes shut. Now, let's try a small trust experiment. Which of the following do you consider the most or least credible? Trust me, I'm a doctor. Trust me, I'm an early years classroom assistant. Trust me, I'm a FTSE 100 chief executive. Or, trust me, I'm a journalist. I'm Matthew Guyver, Jericho Chambers, and we've just produced a new piece of research as part of our Trust Delusion project. Trust is a subject that obsesses business, but is it getting hold of the correct end of the stick when it considers what it should do about it? Our first interview is with an old hand in the trust game. Ben Page from Ipsos Mori has been researching the subject for decades and is very familiar with the direction of trust travel. Ben, every year at this time of the month, we're all considering the crisis of trust. Now, you do an awful lot of research into the subject, and could you tell me how you see the long-term trends? Is it really a kind of something that is sort of getting worse and is coming to a peak now, or has it been a chronic condition?
So no, there is no new crisis of trust, although I think that the rise of populism and the aftermath of the crash of 2008 has left global elites casting around for sort of to understand the challenges and that are posed to them. But no, on trust itself, it's clear that it declined in the late 20th century. But for the last decade or so, to be honest, the trends are mostly flat. In some countries and in some sectors, there is actually rising trust. So it's not like it was in the 1950s or 1960s, but it is quite like it was a decade ago.
It seems that business in particular is very concerned at how it's perceived among the wider public at the moment. And they have a sense that a trust maybe they once had has gone away. Do you think that's true, or is it the same really for business as well?
I think generally what we're seeing for elites, whether they're in politics or business, is greater scrutiny. We are seeing the long-term decline of deference since the end of the Second World War, and that is manifesting itself in people feeling that there must be a sort of a loss of trust. People don't trust me like they used to. But a lot of this is overblown. You know, the classic example is in politics. We're sitting in London, and you know, everybody's saying, we lost the election because of low trust. People, we lost the trust of the electorate. Well, given that the trust in politicians is identically low as it was back in 1983, nothing much has changed.
But there are a lot of business people who can't quite understand why they're put on a level with politicians. It seems to be an accepted truth that politicians are derided, but business people can't quite work out why, you know, they're lumped together with people.
Well, they are the people in charge, and they're also the people with the money. But it actually, of course, as soon as you get into it, you discover that you need to be much more nuanced. So we found that globally, interestingly, tech companies are actually quite trusted, but oil companies and fossil fuel businesses aren't. When you look across Britain, you'll find that supermarkets have reasonable levels of trust because they're relatively transparent. They tell you all the time they're on your side. They're trying to keep prices down and maintain quality. But strangely, utilities and broadband companies, etc., who seem to rip you off and have terrible customer service, aren't. This idea that we are all in a sort of spiral of decline of trust, of a Hobbesian war of all against all, is just completely overblown. And it seems to be more in the interests of people selling PR and support services to keep running this line.
How would you explain then the country's acceptance of an individual who's been fired from two jobs for dishonesty, his marital affairs, come up way short of what most normal people would think would be acceptable?
This is back to another key element about it's always about trust to do what. So would I trust Boris Johnson with my teenage daughter or with my wife? I'm not sure. But it doesn't matter because actually I'm not electing him to do that. And I think the interesting thing, and this is where, again, people get confused about trust and almost put it on an altar where it's not It is not the key or the be-all and end-all in every situation. So if you want to be prime minister in Britain, you do not have to be the candidate who is seen as most honest. I mean, the bottom line is the public accepts that by the time you've got to the top of the greasy pole, you are going to have had to make some difficult decisions and done some difficult things. So Mrs. Thatcher, for example, was always less likely to be seen as honest than Neil Kinnock. He never got to be prime minister. He was ahead of her on honesty right throughout the 1980s. But the reason she won and he didn't, she was seen as competent and good in a crisis. Boris Johnson may or may not be economical with the actuality. However, in terms of getting Brexit done, he was pretty clear that he was going to do that. He had already shown that he might have been more effective at it than Mrs. May. And he certainly appeared to have a clearer story about what he was going to do on it, the number one issue in the general election, than, of course, Mr. Corbyn.
Would you have more confidence ultimately that business can do something about the climate crisis than government?
Well, there's some evidence that that business will have to do more and is going to be part of the solution. And I think ultimately what's interesting on the climate crisis, of course, is that once we start talking about the actual cost to business of not doing things, then we start to see action. The issue will always be, of course, the tragedy of the commons. You know, if you're the one firm that decides not to and can carry on making money, the other five firms are all doing it, when does regulation become important? No, but business does far more good than the public realise. Business has changed dramatically in the 30 years I've been at work in terms of the amount it does. And again, but the problem is that expectations have risen as well. So if I went, Ipsos Mori does infinitely more things than it did when I started as a trainee. It gives infinitely more to charity. We donate thousands of days of pro bono time for things. But if I was to go out and make a big song and dance about that, people would say, well, so what?
It's a hygiene factor,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Just to try to pick it apart a bit, is what you're suggesting for business that don't sweat and get in a complete state about trust. Think about competence.
Yeah.
Think about your customers.
Think about the things that matter most to your customers, either when they're using your service or when they're choosing it. But just being trusted in general, I would say, is pretty meaningless. It needs to be part of the overall culture of the organisation about, doing what we say we will, being open and transparent, these types of things. And over time, if you can build that sort of culture rather than just doing lipstick on a pig, you will outperform.
From a pollster to a professor of philosophy, Baroness Honora O'Neill is a crossbencher in the Lords and gave the hugely influential Reith lectures entitled A Question of Trust. When it comes to trust, she knows her Kant from her Spinoza. Honora, it's 20 years now since your Reith lectures. How has the landscape changed in those two decades?
First of all, it's expanded enormously. There are far more people interested in it and writing on it. And secondly, I like to think that a slightly higher proportion now reckon that trust isn't much to the point if you can't judge trustworthiness. And insofar as people address trustworthiness, I'm entirely convinced that that is a very reasonable thing to do. But it's always complicated. Among other things, we're asked to judge the trustworthiness of so many different things, of technologies, of institutions, of individuals we know personally, of individuals we don't know, God help us, of the media.
Yeah, but how does the critical issue of the culture of business bear down on the trust question?
The culture of large organisations is obviously a very difficult topic to get right, but what we have experienced in the 20th century, and I will say it is we philosophers are to blame for quite a lot of it, is that we started talking only about justice and the norms and standards that are relevant to justice, and ignoring the many other norms and standards which are not optional, but which are not the sorts of things that you can enforce by law. So I have in mind things like honesty, civility, quite a lot of them. It takes more to kill a culture than a few intellectuals trying to narrow it. And there was a reason for narrowing it. If one takes one's mind back to the 1940s, I think the attempt to tie down some absolutely central and indispensable standards and therefore look at the ethical landscape in terms of rights, not duties, was very understandable and may have been essential. But one of the consequences, you lose sight of all the duties that don't have counterpart rights, and that's things like honesty, decency, civility, among others. Many of those, as they used to be called, perfect duties, i.e. no exceptions, but equally the law can't enforce them, many of them have disappeared from public life as though compliance were the only virtue that is left for the well-meaning public servant.
One of the hypotheses of the Trust Illusion Project is that business leaders seem always to use trust in the abstract and not the specific. Why is it that they do this?
Well, a cynical thing to say, and I will say it, is that trust is quite valuable, and if you can get it without earning it, you've got something for nothing, haven't you? And that may be one reason why people hope, both in commercial and sometimes in other campaigning, e.g. political campaigning contexts, to get something for nothing, to get the trust of the customers or the trust of the electorate without having to earn it.
So how do business leaders go about making trust real?
I think they don't start by saying, how can I get more trust? That would, as it were, play into the wrong question. They ask something more like, are we trustworthy? And insofar as we're not, could we do better? And insofar as we are, can we make it easier for people to tell that we are? They're very simple questions in a way.
But still, we see poll after poll and research upon research on the subject of trust.
I know. It's very marketable. I mean, that's a cynical thought, but it's a genuine thought. I think it is very marketable. And look, reputation matters to businesses. It matters to any campaigning organization. It matters to politicians. And they're willing to pay people to do something that is called research, but which is actually just public opinion polling, to provide the evidence. And if you don't get quite the answers you want, maybe you could twiddle the questions a little.
Our initial data from the Trust Illusion Project suggests that there are two specific areas concerning business leaders at the moment: climate change and tech disruption. And between the pair of them, these even outweigh Brexit by 3-1. So there's clearly a lot more than just trust on their minds. Shouldn't we really be considering the subtle relationship between accountability, transparency, and trust?
We have realised that the complexity of structures has made accountability more difficult. And so we have added to the structure. And I think that one of the things that we see all the time is people trying to find some way by regulation by which they can secure accountability. Regulations get very complex. Guess what? People take shortcuts. They dodge. They avoid. And then transparency. Now, transparency, it seems to me, is quite good in itself, in that it makes it possible for someone to discover something about an organization, an institution, be it public sector or business. But it doesn't make it in the least possible for you and me and every other individual to judge these matters because of their complexity. It's a sort of absurdity to think that we will gain public trust by being more transparent. And then people have the feeling, and so I'm to look at all these endless spreadsheets in my massive spare time. Most people can't take the time to do that and may not have the skill to do that.
Next up, one of the UK's most experienced and thoughtful business leaders. Sir Ian Cheshire was CEO of Kingfisher, chairman of Debenhams, before he became chairman of Barclays UK. He's also the lead non-executive director for government. And he was one of the first CEOs in Britain to really take the issues around sustainability seriously. Now, Ian, one of the first things I wanted to ask you is you're probably best known to people in UK business coming from the retail world. So what, when it comes to the issue of trust, was it that attracted you to financial services?
Well, I think it's interesting when you talk about the context of trust, because it is a very different set of expectations I think people have. And one of the things that really struck me was that a large part of the banking trust was the surety that you'd be around in the morning and the money would still be there, which leads to a much longer term rhythm, which is why Barclays is 328 years old and thinks in cycles of, you know, with its balance sheet, thinks in cycles of 5 to 10 years, whereas most retailers have the attention span of a goldfish and are just wondered about next week or next month's sale if you're really strategic. So it's trust has provided a business model in banking because of longevity and the risk of it going wrong, whereas, frankly, the trust involved in choosing which store to go to for a power tool is pretty immaterial.
But do you think that what happened in 2008 was just water off a duck's back for the general public then? I mean, do you think that financial services has been forgiven, or what's happened to the trust level since then?
No, I think there's been clearly a sort of significant trust impact. It's really fascinating, all these surveys that I've seen, when you ask about trust in financial institutions, the answer is sort of near child murderer status. It's pretty low. You asked about the trust in Fred, Ethel and Bert, who run the local branch, up there, right up there with nurses, actually. It's incredibly high. So what it is showing is a dichotomy between belief in the people being in service and seeing people who are generally trying to do the right thing for the customer, which is recognised, and people do trust our staff, and yet the sense that ultimately the institution is not working in the interests of the customer. And that, the 2008 thing, I think, really brought it home.
How important is the role of the leader, the CEO, in this? Because with someone like Polman, for example, at Unilever, he was almost becoming like this sort of heroic figure at the top there. It seems to me there are inherent risks in that as well. Yeah. Not least, it's yet another thing that you're putting on the shoulders of an individual who these days seems often to have an impossible task on their hands.
Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of the concept of the sort of hero CEO solving it all and single-handedly changing the nature of the business and saving the planet on their own. The reality is... I was asked once brilliantly by doing a speech in schools and asked by a 16-year-old, once I told her we had 80,000 people working for me, and she turned around and said, well, so they're in the stores doing all this. What do you actually do? And it was a great question, because the answer was you provide a framework and you create the conditions for other people to succeed. And as CEO in this area, I think without CEO sponsorship and top-level leadership, things don't happen. That is real. That is the one point where you say individuals can make a difference. But the key bit is getting the message so that the organisation actually does it.
How good a job do you think business has done over the last few years of pointing out to broader society what its value is? Because it seems to me, as I remember I did when I did the BBC programme about it, and we did a Vox Pop on Oxford Street outside John Lewis, and we said to a woman who was with her mum, she was a nurse, and her mother, and they said, oh, business, they're just all out there for themselves, money, you know, I don't trust them. Where's it come from? Because it's quite a corrosive thing, isn't it?
I'm not sure it's a new thing, though. I mean, I think people could argue that business has always been perceived to be out for itself, going back to Middle Ages merchants. There's a certain sort of aspect to that. I think what business has to do much more, and this is maybe more around a question of purpose rather than trust, because I think if you don't have the content of a purpose, you can't really have a conversation about trust. And I think what we're now seeing with the new cohort, new generations coming through, and social media making business so much more transparent than it's ever been, is the difference between those businesses seen as having a positive purpose and the willingness to engage them and understand then they do make money, but they do it in a way which is in service of customers. And therefore, it's also a place that employees want to be part of and they align with that purpose. That is really the job that business has to be much more aggressive about articulating.
But how are they going to do it?
Two things. Firstly, you've got to have an authentic purpose relevant to your operation. And one of the things I found really fascinating is that we hadn't at Kingfisher had a specific purpose. We had a few ideas. And we had this business all around the world selling DIY products. And actually, when we got into the emotional engine for the business and we did interviews with customers and colleagues all over the world, you kept on coming back to this motive of I want a better home. And actually, what I really want is a better life. And I achieve a better life by having a better home. So I'm not just buying a tin of paint. I am doing the nursery up because my first child's coming in. I want to fix this bathroom because I want it to be a lovely place to spend time. And literally that resonated all the way around the world. And it also provided the people in the stores with a very different type of conversation because they, instead of saying, do you want this bit of stuff? The first question is, well, what are you doing and how are you improving your home? And the most routinely sort of important thing in people's lives is their home. So you're in a heartland, which is very warm, very personal, as opposed to very transactional and very sort of functional. And that absolutely worked in spades for us. And I think it's different for different companies. So that won't work for another company. And some companies, frankly, might struggle to have a real purpose. But I think the ones that can articulate a purpose and then critically stay true to it. So the challenge for Google, for example, do no evil in the current environment, not clear. It's a great starting point, but it's not clear. It's still an authentic purpose. Ditto Facebook.
So the things that keep you awake at night then, how on the list of 1 to 10 does high does trust come?
To be honest, I would say quite a long way down that list because top of it is our customers and our technological boundaries are changing so fast. If you take the average bank strategic plan back in 2007-08, I'm pretty sure no one mentioned the smartphone in it. And 10 years later, their entire business model for retail banking had been upended by technological change. Secondly, I think we're all very clear that climate change is an existential threat for all of us. And so, one might want more trust, but actually we've got other things to fix right now. And the third thing for me is if we're going through this transition and we've got these challenges, actually, where do we find the skills, the right people? So in some senses, trust, it sounds like it's sort of a long way down the line. Actually, in order to actually make a difference, I think you're going to have to articulate a purpose and show how you're going to help with these crises and these changes. And that will lead to trust, but that's the output rather than the thing you're trying to chase. So it's the same thing of, if you set out to try and be happy, that may not probably work. If you set out to be rich, it may not work. If you do the right thing in the right way for the right people, those are results that follow.
From the director of an organisation with the reputation of a child murderer to Bobby Duffy, who is now Professor of Public Policy and Director of the Policy Institute at King's College London. Fukuyama writes about, he says it's the glue of a successful capitalist economy, isn't it? I mean, it's there in the kind of acceptance of the word, being my bond and those sorts of things. And in a complete absence of trust, as you could argue you maybe had, in the Soviet Union, things just don't function because you don't believe anything you're told by anybody, really,
yeah,
do you?
That's right. I mean, like the old apocryphal sayings about with zero trust, you don't get out of bed in the morning. I mean, you have to have some of that. There's definitely elements of truth in that. And there's definitely lots of research that shows the links between high trust or high social capital in societies, in organizations, and better outcomes for people. There's the controversy over, the causal relationship between those. So it's not without contesting that actually is this a core causal ingredient of it. But if you strip it right back to a complete absence of trust, that would have terrible consequences for any organization, any society.
So if you're being consistently approached then by businesses saying we've got a real kind of crisis of trust, what in a sort of corporate psychological sense is that a reflection of it? I mean, is it a kind of lack of self-confidence, a lack of belief that they're sort of, moving in the right direction, or they're just finding life incredibly competitive far too difficult?
Yeah, I think it's all of those elements, plus a lot of media coverage of when things go wrong and attacks in the media on individuals or individual businesses or individual sectors on ways in which they've acted that don't seem to show trust. So the kind of mostly it comes up where there's a media spotlight on a particular sector or business where some of their behaviours are seen as misleading the public or not in line with their purpose, their stated purpose. And that kind of increase in coverage, media coverage, scrutiny, social media coverage and scrutiny of those types of behaviours is definitely an element in the increased sensitivity to trust. We've just got, it's much harder now to hide things from people, and it much easier for things to be amplified very quickly.
Now, I know that one of the things you're very interested in, and indeed it will be the subject of your next book, of the difference between generations. Mm. Now, when you kind of consider the generations, it seems to be just sort of filled with stereotypical images of snowflake generation Zers and, you know, boomers who are complacent and all pro-Brexit and don't give a monkeys about the kind of coming generation. So how do you, in your researches, what have you found then as kind of in the general sense that the differences when it comes to trust between different generations?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the trends in trust, in professions, in business, in lots of different areas of life, there is no real generational difference. This is not younger cohorts of people coming in with lower trust in business. In fact, higher trust in business. And it's sort of, that is much more a life cycle effect than a cohort effect, a generational effect. It's just actually, we learn not to trust over our life course. So you see repeated waves of young people coming in with a higher level of trust in business in particular, and then just losing it over time because of, you know, bad experiences or just increased cynicism.
What about, is there a correlation between trust and the happiness index? I'm interested in that because the Scandis tend to sort of do quite well on both, don't they? What are your thoughts on that subject?
It's an interesting question. So internationally, I'm not sure, to be honest. When I did a secondment at Prime Minister's Strategy Unit for a while, and the two subjects I were looking at was life satisfaction and trust and the connection between the two. So certainly in terms of when you look more within the UK and you look at the groups that are highly trusting and the groups that are very happy, there is similar characteristics between those types of groups. So you're not sure whether you can say high happiness countries are highly trusting countries.
So what then, as a result of your research, is when you're in the Prime Minister's unit, did you recommend they do to make people happier?
My work was actually towards the end of Tony Blair Prime Ministerial role, but it did lay the groundwork for lots of the thinking that was carried on by David Cameron. And yes, so there is still this tracking of satisfaction levels. And this is one of the things that is really worth emphasising. One of my big areas of research interest now is how polarised and divided Britain is. Is it as divided as we think? And one of the key points to make in that is that both happiness levels and trust levels, trust in other people, trust in institutions, are not collapsing. If anything, they are going up slightly over time in lots of different ways, not always, and still a lot of cynicism around government and politics at its, you know, at its most political. But lots of other aspects, trust in other people, gone up. Trust in professions, lots of great surveys that Ipsos do, gone up. This idea that we are divided and miserable is not the reality, day-to-day reality outside of the 7 seconds that normal people give to thinking about Brexit. It's not the day-to-day concern for most people, and they're getting on with things.
So should one be optimistic then in the long term? Rather, I mean, because it seems to me that at the moment the popular narrative among the chatterati is that, you know, we are deeply divided and all kind of fed up. You know, they've asked the government to get Brexit done because they're, you know, rather than kind of thinking about the possible consequences, they're just fed up with even talking about it. They want it sort of put behind us. How do you foresee the kind of levels changing over the next sort of 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, so that is the key point, is a lot of my other work is about misperceptions and how do people misperceive reality. Very important for polarisation as well, because people see the same realities differently if you're in a different tribe or you have a different identity. That's very important to you. And what one of the key effects in the misperceptions world is that we have an inbuilt focus on negative information. So this is an evolutionary trait that we have, where in cave people days, if there was a lurking saber-toothed tiger, you had to take note of that or you were edited out of the gene pools. So that focus on the negative is exactly what this trust crisis plays into. It leaves a space for people who say, it's all going downhill, nothing's working, we need to rip up the system and start again. So I agree with presenting a more realistic, which is actually optimistic view, is important not to pat ourselves on the back or to encourage complacency, but to counter this inbuilt trend to focus too much on the negative.
Finally, it's about time that we heard from somebody under the age of 45. After all, they are our future. Chantel Pinder is 22 and a law graduate from Exeter University, now working for an IT company. She came to the UK as a refugee with her mother and brother, aged 8. So what does trust mean for her?
Do you think there's a significant kind of generational difference in the way in which people of your generation in their early 20s trust institutions and things and business compared to, you know, people like me in their kind of 50s and, God help us, 60s?
100%. I think my generation is very, very, very sceptical. I always say this. I think it's because the more we're kind of exposed to things like social media and information and how quickly we can access it, we tend to over-research, tend to look into things a lot. We tend to look upon many things with a lot of suspicion. I dub myself an optimistic pessimist. At least I try to be.
I mean, I suppose if you think about business, you are hearing a conversation coming up to have a purpose, you know, a social purpose about what they do. Is that something that you're kind of sensing maybe they're getting a bit better at?
Yes and no. Yes, because you do see a lot of things like the terms corporate social responsibility being thrown around here, there and everywhere. To the point that that was even a career path that I thought was something that you could do. Like you could be a regulator of CSR and firms. And what I find is that a lot of it does tend to just be talk.
So who do you kind of trust then out there? The NHS? Doctors, nurses, teachers?
I don't know. I think it's a really difficult question because I guess it comes down to context in terms of doctors. You wonder, why wouldn't I trust my doctor? Teachers, why wouldn't I trust my teacher? But then you kind of veer off into the politicians. Why would I trust my politicians? So it definitely does depend on the institution you're talking about.
It's an interesting concept, isn't it? Because what a lot of people say is that when businesses talk about a kind of crisis of trust, what they actually need to think about is not sort of buying in some trust or what have you, but actually behaving in a trustworthy way. Do you still find, even with businesses that you interact with on a regular basis, that you're not kind of willing to go that extra bit and say, I trust you? What about your bank, for example? What's your attitude towards them?
I have a bit of a split view on this, mainly because my background is that my family come from Zimbabwe and I was able to go home and visit recently this year. And what I found is that when you're in a country like that, it's difficult. Like the question is almost, is there going to be money in the bank? Not, do I trust my bank to look after my money? So I'm kind of split in the sense that I have the luxury here of thinking, yes, I can trust that the bank will have my money. And if not, there's a solution around the corner. So I've got comfort and I've got a kind of padding for that comfort. But on the other side, I can see how someone could turn around and say, no, I don't trust my bank. I'll just keep my money under my pillow. I have the luxury of seeing it from both ways and very clearly.
Would you have said that the average individual in Zimbabwe is even more sceptical and cynical of the political class there than they are here in this country?
100%, and rightly so, because there's a lot less transparency. Here, we force transparency. For a lot of people, it's the be-all and end-all. With political parties, if you're going to vote for someone, you need some sense of transparency. Whether it's real or not, that's a different issue, but there is that impetus for it.
Do you trust Greta Thunberg? She seems pure in her beliefs and her
Definitely.
Ideology. She tries to do, you know, live by her promises. I mean, what did you make of her then when she first appeared
on the scene? I mean, did you relate to her and you thought, well, finally, you know, there's somebody who comes along and kind of talks my language and feels as if they're from my generation?
Rather than her age, it's more about her character and how she portrays that and puts that out to the world in her convictions, how she acts, how she speaks. I mean, she's really passionate about when she speaks about things. And not that being passionate when you speak is a precursor to trust. It's just the fact that she says what she says, she means what she means, and she does what she says she's going to do. That those three things are so important when it comes to trust.
But how do you think she would fare if she actually got some political power to do something? I mean, I know she can influence, mm-hmm. and indeed she has influence,
yeah.
but how well do you think she'd do when it actually came going day in, day out, making those difficult decisions, having to be the one with whom the buck stops?
Yeah. My optimist side is saying she'd do amazingly. And that's just kind of based on the, like you said, she's pure. And I don't know why, but to me, it's the idea of someone that age. If she were to do it alone, not having to balance a lot of interests, just we know what she's about. We know what kind of things she would propose and what she would do. I think she would do well, just having that conviction and having that genuine passion towards it. I think she'd do it for free, honestly.
So what should we conclude from all this? I think it's become a commonplace to say that business is more mistrusted today than ever before, but I'm simply not convinced this is true. And what we've heard in this podcast backs that up. Was there really ever a golden age of trust? What about the Victorian era when robber barons ruled the land and children were put up chimneys down mines? Charles Dickens laboured in a bootblacking factory aged 12. The 1920s and 30s were decades of bitter strikes, worker lockouts and compulsory wage cuts. In recent decades, we've had Robert Maxwell, Polly Peck, Enron, all way before the crash of 2008. But what is true, however, is that that mistrust of business is mostly confined, I think, to large companies. It's unusual for people to feel so hostile towards businesses in their own communities. And indeed, if they did, these SMEs would be unlikely to survive. There's something about the size that comes with success and growth that engenders trouble on the trust front. Maintaining clear purpose, engagement among your staff, and your integrity is undoubtedly far harder once the boss no longer knows everyone. So try and be trustworthy and don't keep going on about trust. I'm Matthew Guyther from Jericho Chambers, and thank you for listening.